Do you think there can be a formula for genius and mastery? Success was demystified somewhat in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Outliers. Mastery, the new book by Robert Greene, offers insights for gaining perspective into our own lives by blending historical anecdotes and psychological insights into a smooth mix of, oh, so this is how it works. But can hindsight work in this way? One thing is for sure. Robert Greene is an engaging writer, as proven by his international bestsellers, The 48 Laws of Power, and collaboration with 50 Cent, The 50th Law. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Wow, Robert, how does your hand keep up with your head to write these books? I don't believe they're very linear processes.
Well, they're books that can take several years to write. They involve a lot of research. My goal is to be able to describe what I'm writing about in as realistic a fashion, to really, really understand it deeply, so that I'm not just toying with the reader or trying to make money. I really, really want to connect you with something real, and it takes several years, and I have to be patient, and I have to go through a process and organize my material. And sometimes it's not particularly sexy. It can be a little bit tedious. But I genuinely love it, and if my goal is to connect you to something powerful, then that's sort of, the North Star that's guiding me, and that's kind of an exciting process. So I genuinely love what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I love how you've set the book up. It's almost like the I Ching of mastery. You hop into the index and you see what grabs you. And then that one story or tip or suggestion can feed a lot of the roads in a personal journey. Just like you said, it's the North Star, and there are a lot of journeys to the North Star. But when you hold that one focus, it's amazing how it all can unfold.
Well, what I like about Asian philosophy, I've been studying it for years, is that it's more lifelike. It's not about, do A, B, and C. It's a little bit broader than that, and it involves sometimes doing many different things in life, or taking roads that are seemingly counterintuitive, and having a flow. And so the book is structured like that. I'm very influenced by books like the I Ching, so that you can look in the table of contents and you can see the chapter on creativity, for instance, which comes later in the book, and you can go, that really pertains to where I am right now. I've already gone through an apprenticeship phase, but I don't feel like my mind is operating on quite the creative level it needs to be. And I have a chapter that goes into, that's the longest chapter in the book, into what I call awakening the dimensional mind, and very clear ideas about how you can do that and how people in the past have done it. And so you can pick and choose what applies to your life. And I also make it clear these are not hard and fast rules. What applies to Pablo Picasso doesn't apply necessarily to Albert Einstein. They're different fields, they're different moments in life. And so I'm trying to give you a sense of these are things that you can apply and maybe not, and what are the opposite, what's the opposite approach or the reverse of what I'm saying. And because I've discovered that people in life who just follow formulas don't really get very far. It's more like an overall philosophy that I'm trying to give you.
Yes, and it is. It's almost like if this book was actually formulaic, it would defeat its own purpose.
Well, that's the problem with a lot of self-help books, and why you buy them, because the title is seductive. It looks interesting, and then you get into it. It's like candy, it tastes good originally, but there's no substance to it. In fact, it kind of makes you a little bit sick. You've laid out your money, and there's nothing real there, and it's because the writer didn't really take the time to go deep into the process, and they're giving you formulas. And I don't want to do that. I take this role that I have in life very seriously. you know, I could go on for 10 years writing this book. Unfortunately, I have deadlines and I have to earn a living as well, but I take it really seriously, and I want to, if I'm talking to you about mastery and how you can master your field, I want to get you as close as possible there, and that's always been my goal.
Well, this comes on the heels of your book, The 48 Laws of Power.
Yeah.
What do you think led you from that, from power, into mastery?
Well, I had noticed in researching very powerful figures in that particular book, it would be, you know, Louis XIV or Napoleon Bonaparte or whomever. I've noticed that they all tended to follow this sort of pattern in life. They all had a somewhat similar path. And as I did my other books after that, this idea kept getting stronger. And then I realized that there's this, if I could describe to the reader what that path is, the process that leads them to the point where they've mastered their field, where they have sort of an intuitive grasp of what to do, that would be a very powerful weapon I could give people. Because we have these misconceptions in our culture that people who are very successful, very powerful, very creative, we generally think, oh, they had a high IQ, a bigger brain, good education, and it's not the case. It's not the case at all. They had a genuine love of their field, and they went through a process that I can describe to you. And so accumulating that knowledge for myself over the years, I just really reached a point where I wanted to be able to describe this overarching kind of theme that I had seen in all of the lives of these incredibly interesting people I had researched.
And I think what you're describing right now is a big reason why, as you mentioned earlier, your largest chapter or section in your book was Awakening the Dimensional Mind. That's kind of key, it would seem to me.
Well, here, you know, everything sort of fits in with what came before in these books. And so in the first chapter, I set out the idea that you need to find, discover your life's task, what it is that you were meant to accomplish in life, to pursue something that connects with you on some level. And then if you do that, you're going to be more engaged and you're going to learn faster. And if you go through the process a little bit faster with that intensity that I'm talking about, eventually the mind will awaken with creative powers that I believe everybody is born with. If you look at children, children are naturally creative. Their minds are constantly associating ideas in the most surprising manner. That's the nature of the human brain that you were born with, but it gets drummed out of you after years of school and conforming to what other people think you should do and other ways. You know, your ideas get rigid. And if you go through the process and you learn deeply at your field and you maintain that kind of excitement and childlike spirit, eventually, you're going to return to that earlier period in childhood. Your mind's going to come alive with all of these ideas that you can associate and connect. But it's going to be on a much higher level than a child, because now you're older, you're wiser, and you have all of this experience and practice. And all of the masters that I've studied, and I interviewed 9 contemporary masters, they have that kind of interesting childlike quality where they're still curious about the world. And, you know, the chapter is very long, and I have all sorts of ideas, the main thing being about keeping the mind fluid and open and not conventional and rigid. But the main thing, really, is maintaining that sense of wonder and curiosity, and that there's still things that you need to learn. I have a great quote in there from Albert Einstein on that very theme, that, you know, even into his 50s and 60s, he still felt like he was a child.
Well, I think these are very interesting times, in that those that have time and money are undertaking philosophies such as this, mastery. They take workshops, they join groups, and then there are folks that really use their days to literally survive. And I'm wondering, at the end of the day, do you think one group really would be more conscious or with the program than another? Does survival mode induce necessity for that environmental connection for seamless movement through life?
Well, I don't like to discriminate on that level, because I have plenty of examples of people who come from the worst circumstances you can imagine. And that'll include, the writer Zora Neale Hurston. I tell her story, the great African-American writer, and where she came from. Or it's Temple Grandin, the contemporary figure who was born with autism. It's really not your socioeconomic background or how much you're hurting in life. I mean, it definitely makes it harder if you've got a family to feed and you're struggling out there. What do you have time for? But you'd be surprised how much time people waste. And if you are at a point where you feel like you've got to make a change, instead of wasting time on the internet, you go to a community college. There are all sorts of resources online to learn new skills. It's more on your attitude. Have you given up?
Right. Well, that was my point. It's, someone may not actually consciously go through steps. Okay, I've got to do this, and then I've got to do that, and I've got to do that to be a master. But just because they're in that survival mode, they move there organically.
Oh, a very good point, and I agree with you. And the process is organic. Once you connect with your what I call your life's task, your calling, the process almost occurs like a plant growing. It just sort of happens, because if you are excited, then you will choose something that interests you, and then you will pay deeper attention, and you will learn, and you will develop patience, and you will get skill, and then the mind will become creative and intuitive. So you're right, there is something organic, and it will fall into place, and I'm just kind of going to gently guide you along the way. But it's really up to you and the point in life that you're at, and whether you believe it's possible. And I'm trying to make the argument, which I pretty much pound into your brain, that it's eminently realizable if you spend the time and you're willing to spend 5-10 years learning something. Your brain is wired for this kind of intelligence. And you either believe it and then you try it, or you fill with doubt and pessimism and all the ugly things in our culture, the cynicism, and you never actually realize your potential.
Right. I mean, whatever we put out in our field certainly does extend beyond us, and then that's what we sort through forever. I thought it was a really great call to include social intelligence as one of the paths toward mastery. And I'm wondering, what is a most impressive aspect in order to override this compulsion to deal with resistances and manipulations of people around us?
Well, we humans are the preeminent social animals. You can't divorce ourselves from the social context. It's where we learn language, it's where we learn how to operate in a culture or whatever. And I want to make the point that you could become a great master at some skill and know everything you need to know, but if you don't know how to deal with people, it's pretty useless. And, there's certain problems that we all have. We're not really good at reading other people. I go into the science of this. I go into what we call mirror neurons, the unique ability that primates have to literally put themselves in the minds of other people and try and imagine what they're thinking. We're born with that power. It's an amazing, remarkable power, but we don't use it. We're listening to ourselves too much. We're thinking, as we're in a conversation with someone, we're thinking, oh, this is what I'm going to say next. This is what I think. And you want to shut that off, and you want to become just sort of absorbing what people are saying and listening to them on a deep level. A, it's great therapy. B, it is going to increase your knowledge of human nature. You're going to understand people and empathize with them more. And then the other aspect of social intelligence is not being so naive. There are people out there who are just manipulative, who can make your life miserable. They're political creatures. They're not everyone, maybe 1 in 10. And you got to recognize that that people will feel envy, and they won't say that they feel envious, and then they'll go and they'll attack you in ways you don't understand. I don't want to make you paranoid. I just want to make you realistic and understand there's certain elements of human nature, and that if a person is suddenly becoming super friendly with you in the office, that maybe you don't take it at face value, that that's often a sign that someone is up to something. There's something else motivating them besides a genuine interest in you. Signs like that. And just making you more a socially aware person. Generally, I hate to say it, but I generally feel like women are much better at this than men. They're more socially attuned to picking up the signs that people give, and it's why in some ways women do better nowadays in certain aspects of the work world. But men have the capacity as well, and there's no, you're not going to be successful in life unless you can manage this extremely important aspect.
Well, I'm sure, or I shouldn't say I'm sure, I guess, but it seems that you've become more and more in your own life an observer. And I think in order to write a book like Mastery, you would have to be. And I'm wondering, when, as we become more of an observer of our own lives, is there more or less control, do you think? Do you get any sense of an invisible guidance coming into play more? And is that important?
Well, you know, it's weird. You can get a feeling of, like, destiny, that things sort of happen for a good reason, or that they can be that way. I don't know if that's real or not, but it's a nice way to think about life, so that if bad things happen, oh, it happened for a reason. I know, for instance, that when I was writing this book, I was late in delivering it, and a publisher kind of cracked the whip and said, "You have 2.5 months to finish the book, or something bad will happen." And it just was like terrible. I was exhausted, and the last two chapters had to be written, which were the longest, and I just didn't think I could make it. And I ended up finding another gear, and I did it. I turned it in with 5 minutes to spare. And basically, it was a blessing in disguise. It made me concentrate much more. It made me write at this furious pace, and all of these ideas came to me. And that's how I sort of view things. If something goes wrong, there's an advantage and an opportunity to that. The other point that you have is, you know, writers have to be observers. That's the nature of the game. That's what makes you a good writer, is if you're able to get inside the brains of other people. You know, I have many stories of writers like that. And so, you know, it's sort of about being socially aware and getting into the minds of other people. It can come with a price, in that sometimes you'd wonder who you are because you're always inside other people. So that can be a problem. But if you want to be a writer and you don't have that interest or ability, it's not going to work out.
What's the most surprising element of Mastery to you?
Well, you know, I've always been excited by the idea of what I call high-level intuition. So you've spent 20 years doing something, chess, dancing, science, and suddenly you're able to come up with some invention or new way of doing things that just makes everybody mouths drop. Wow, my God, what an amazing work of art. What an incredible discovery. And if you look at these people, they all talk about it coming in a flash, like an intuition, like out of nowhere this idea came. And it just excited me to no end to describe that, because it's a real phenomenon, but nobody writes about it. And what I was surprised is all the masters talk about it, and you can break it down. You can see where it comes from. It's not like I can't say it follows the steps A, B, and C, but you take someone like Einstein, who spent 10 years thinking deeply about his theory that turned into special relativity, day and night and day and night, and this thought experiment and that thought experiment, and then finally, after 10 years of that insane mental labor, a light bulb goes on in his head. Yes, time is relative, and it came to him in an image in his mind, just an image. I can talk to you about how that happens. I can explain to you where, you know, the groundwork that you need in order to have that intuition. You know, I was a little bit impressed or surprised that I could do that, and you know, not make it something mystical or cult. I mean, it's still, I can't totally explain it, but I can give you, I can explain it enough so that it's a real thing and it's something you could aim for in life.
Was it difficult to decide what mastery means, or was that important as an initial step or as you work through this book?
Well, it's a, you know, I have a, the method of, I start with a premise, which I've laid out to you before about these masters in life have this certain process they go through, and a feeling about sort of what mastery is, leading to that intuition. And then everything's open. I read books on science and how the brain works and creativity and all these biographies, and I let the material tell me what I need to know. I don't hoist my own opinions on things. I let the material speak to me. Mm-hmm. And so as I go deeper into the material, I'll change a chapter that I thought I was going to write, or I'll go off in a new direction, or I'll open it up to a new idea three quarters of the way through because it's real, because I see a pattern, I see something there. So I begin with a general framework, because if I didn't, it would be too massive an attempt. But I keep the mind open to letting the material tell me what's real, you know, and I feel like that's sort of what works for me.
Yes. Robert, there are so many, many great vignettes in Mastery, and I'm wondering if you could share one of your favorite stories of someone in there.
Well, there are many. You know, there's one of my favorite stories is in the last chapter about the great French writer Marcel Proust, who, you know, maybe some people haven't heard of, and others will like, well, why is this person a master? And his story is so amazing. First of all, he wrote a novel called In Search of Lost Time, seven volumes. It's, I think, perhaps the greatest novel that's ever written. But what's interesting about Proust is he was a bit of a loser. He couldn't find what he wanted to do in life. He wanted to write, but he didn't know what to write. And he became sort of a social butterfly and went to all these parties and tried to write about high society, and it didn't work. And his parents thought gave up on him, and he turned himself into a translator, which gave him some money, but he couldn't find it. And finally, at the age of 36 or 37, he decides he's going to write a novel about the fact, about a young man who can't figure out what he wants to do in life. It's his own story. And so as he starts telling his own story, all of his experiences, the apprenticeship he went through, all his failures, suddenly he realizes that they were his education, that his own story is what's so interesting. And he goes on to write a novel for the next 13 years that's so profound, that's so built on his own life and his own failures and his own search, that I believe he pierces a level of reality and psychology that no one has ever approximated. But what I try to tell people is the faith that you must have, because he never really gave up. Life is teaching you, if your eyes are open, and all of the things that you've had, all the experiences, even, I was a waiter, I've had 80 different jobs, they all taught me something in the end that I've been able to use. And it was his attitude, and how he never gave up, and then he turned what seemed to be a failure into this insanely brilliant novel. I just love that story.
Right. Well, I'm a sucker for any Polynesian voyaging stories myself. And what you've included in Mastery with that story and telling how when the Polynesians, they were so masterful at going from point A to point B in the islands where there was no way that you could actually find your way, really. And it was like they opted into being like they were totally still in, like they were sitting in a moving train. And I just think that's a great metaphor for it all, as most everything in the book is, of course. But that just struck me that it's that intense observation and mindfulness. And
Well, the context of that is the book I talk a lot about our most primitive ancestors and how the brain evolved, and that I try and show that mastery is not just a function of language and being civilization. It goes back millions of years, and it's basically our mastery of the environment, our knowledge of the environment, to the point that we have an intuitive feel for the landscape. This is what hunter-gatherers had millions of years ago, and so it's hardwired into the evolution of the human brain. And the Caroline Islanders, that's what you're talking about, are the most insanely brilliant example of this, because they live in this world that's 99% water, and they are able to navigate through that world from island to island because there's not enough food on their own islands to survive. And they have no instruments. There's no navigation tools. They have these canoes that are the same since 5,000 years ago. And it's all by mapping through the stars and observing the environment and knowing the water so well that they can feel it and sense the changes in temperature and how it tastes and whether there's land nearby. Their focus was so great that they turned the water into basically walking on land. And that's the power that the human brain can have when it focuses. I don't know if people are familiar with the great writer Colin Wilson, and he writes many books about this. We have no idea what the human brain is capable of when we actually focus it deeply on something. They're untapped powers.
Definitely.
That's sort of what fascinates me about indigenous cultures or people like the Caroline Islanders.
Yes, and you mentioned that the landscape, to our lives, it's very metaphorical, and it certainly reaches way beyond and from looking out and seeing negative space as opposed to the actual physical thing. Look into that negative space, and I think that there'll be many of us looking forward to your next book. We'll see where power goes into mastery, and then mastery goes into we will see.
Maybe I'll write a book about my cat or something totally different.
Yeah, something very spiritual like your cat. You know, I have to say, I'm glad you wrote about power first and then mastery, because if you had written mastery and then power, I might have been a little suspect here.
Oh, okay. Well, it's all an evolution. And I think reading the Zeitgeist, power was sort of, is timeless, but it fit a certain period. And now I feel like it's time for people to be more serious and sober and learn how to make things well and solve problems. That's sort of, I think, fits what we're going through right now.
Robert, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoy this.
Robert Greene's book is entitled Mastery. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for the weekly report of shows, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.